Welcome to Subtitles, where we spike the canon in music and movies. In each episode, we will offer up replacements for each title in the top 100 of a well-known, well-regarded ranking, and we'll walk away with a pair of subtitles which we think deserve more acclaim and to which attention must be paid. I'm Matt, and I'm replacing the top 100 entries on Spin Magazine's 2015 list of the top 300 albums from 1985 until 2015, starting with number one and working down.
And I'm Tim. I'm replacing the entries on the 2007 AFI 100 Years, 100 Movies list, starting with number 100 and working up.
Once we finish this off, we'll do some fun activities with the new replacement lists we've collaborated on, but before we can get there, we have to do this. Today's title to be replaced is If You're Feeling Sinister, the 1996 album by Belle and Sebastian. I almost read the I'm Tim part, and you would think after 64 episodes or whatever, I'd have that down pretty smoothly, but here we are.
Or your whole life, where you have, in fact, never been Tim.
I know. I don't have a replacements album named after me.
No, that's my special. Claim to fame.
I choose to believe your parents just really love that album. I know they weren't listening to the Replacements, but...
Could you imagine if they'd been hiding that from me all this time? Like, they had secretly been, like, huge The Replacements fans and...
Fucking incredible. Tim's parents, if you're listening, just pretend that's true.
I think I may as well. It's a lot more entertaining than the usual answer I get, which is, yeah, it seemed nice. So...
Speaking of, do you think there are kids named Belle and or Sebastian because of Belle and Sebastian?
Yes, I think that's actually a very high probability, though. My guess is that the number of cats named Belle and Sebastian who live together has to be just staggering.
That's a fair point. Here's a follow-up. Which X and Y musical group, act, whatever, do you think has become the name of the most pairs of cats?
I mean, Belle and Sebastian would honestly, like, I think that's got to be top three, right? Just because the whole cat, like, those people. Yeah. There's got to be a lot of... cats named Sam the Sham, and then a lot of cats named the Pharaohs.
One cat named the Pharaohs.
Yeah, yeah.
All right, I dig it. I want there to be a bunch of Hall & Oates kitties, but I may have to be that one.
I mean, I don't know. Is Simon and Garfunkel number one?
Sonny and Cher?
Well, they already don't like each other that much, I guess. Yeah. Like, you have the one cool cat you name Cher, and then you have the weird cat. Call him Sonny.
Well, everyone playing along at home, I don't know, send us your answers. Yes. I think Belle and Sebastian has a lot of juice there. Anyway, talking about actual music, what am I, 64, 65?
I think this is 65.
65, thank you, Tim. Number 65 on the spin list. Let me ask you this. You knew about this one beforehand, right? How do I want to ask this? This is going to sound rude. Who still listens to Belle and Sebastian?
That's a really interesting question. I think maybe no one, possibly. Like, there's this, they are so much of this individual time, I feel like, of this, like, late 90s. I mean, I know they're around before then, but, like, especially this late 90s, like, indie vibe. And then, I don't know, it's sort of like the spirit of what indie vibes meant changed, because they are an and band and not a the band. And maybe that explains some of the washing of tides over them in a really Scottish way. I don't know. But I feel like the last high point must have been reactions to the Juno soundtrack, right? Like that like particular moment in indie history where they all tried to come back at once.
Juno and Garden State theorem.
I'm a real believer in it.
Yeah, me too. There have to be a bunch of Tegan and Sarah cats. I just thought of that one.
That was the one I was missing. I'm like, there's one obvious one. Who is that? And yes, that's the one.
There it is. Butthole and Surfers.
Would that band make more sense if it were if it were Butthole and Surfers as opposed to the Butthole Surfers?
Or Butthole and the Surfers?
I can believe that band exists already, actually.
It's probably in West Texas somewhere. Bell and Sebastian. I asked that. The timing thing is really what I was on to there. Like, obviously people still listen to Bell and Sebastian, but I think that was the shadow question there was like, do the kids find and listen to Bell and Sebastian? And I don't know. I don't think. Which it also feels like we're on kind of a general run where I've been saying, I don't know, kind of that. Well, maybe not now that I look at it again. I mean, it's certainly come up in past episodes, but mm-hmm. like Drake wasn't too long ago. So like, we're not totally in a Gen Z dead zone here. But Belle and Sebastian does feel like they're in that. And I'd be hard pressed to tell you how often I hear them or hear about them in the wild. That said, you can hear them in so much indie music from 2000 onwards. So like, they're present if you know about them, if this is something that was important to you, that you had a phase with. You can hear them everywhere. But literal Belle and Sebastian, which part of their shtick was they did not want to be known at all, and I respect that deeply. so, right, there's a lot of obscurity to begin with that, I mean, I'm sure affects their, like, ongoing, not even perception, just ongoing knowledge or awareness of. But, yeah, I don't, like, you know, I say this for a lot for different reasons, but I'm really curious if, you know, when Spin updates this list, by which I mean when new music critics are taking over, like slightly younger ones, 5 to 10 years younger, what happens with If You're Feeling Sinister? I think maybe it survives another round in the top 100, I mean, or maybe Boy with the Arab Strap tips over. Like, I think maybe it has one more in it. And then after that, boy, I don't know. Maybe it gets like grandparented in as like folks just recognize, okay, this one's important and it sets up so much else, and like it's gonna be in this like, you know, 60 to 80 range that's kind of forgettable, honestly, in the grand scheme of top 100s. But yeah, I don't know, I'm really curious about that one. Not even as just like a, will perceptions of them change? Will they become retrograde? Or like, will they not sound fresh? Or like, it's not even any of that. Just like, who's going to keep listening to this band? And I don't know.
Yeah,
I'm sad about that, but
I've been staring at my side of our Google sheet here, and I'm like trying to figure out what the movie equivalent is, which is usually, I don't know, when we do that, I feel like that's usually useful for at least one of us. And I'm like kind of struggling to figure out who they are, like this, like you can see them, hear them in everything, but I don't know who's watching it. And man, I don't know, is it not like thematically or anything, but I wonder if it's like the African Queen, where like the weird rom-com and the weird setting thing, like everybody knows it, but who's watching the African Queen anymore? I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, that one sticks out. I mean, is it the one for today?
The one for today is... I have so many weird thoughts about this one, so... But, I mean, it's a similar idea, like a British carryover that we all pretend is American, even though we clearly should not.
Or is it like some Buster Keaton, John? Yeah, I don't know. Like, that's a good question. I don't really, offhand, I don't really know. Or not in the top 100, anyway. If you're unfamiliar with Belle and Sebastian, which you're not, just give me a minute. I forget the Juno soundtrack. What was on there?
Oh, it's Well Respected Man by the Kinks is on there. The entire discography of Kimya Dawson is on there.
I know that that one Honeybee song is there.
Yes, that one is there.
Yeah.
Is Piazza New York Catcher the Belle and Sebastian song they put on that?
That's what I meant. Like, I forget the Belle and Sebastian on there. That would make sense, though. It's probably that.
Yes, it is.
Yeah. Anyway, I keep going on tangents, and I think it's just because, like, Belle and Sebastian is a band that feels utterly ingrained to me, such that, like, I don't really know how to talk about them because they just show up in so much else that I've listened to. We throw the word twee around a lot, too much, I think. But this, my friends, this is twee. If you have ever struggled or just wondered, like, I hear that and I'd like have a vague grasp of it, a working knowledge maybe, but I don't really understand. Listen to If You're Feeling Sinister, and this is twee. I rarely hate on twee, so I don't say that disparagingly at all. I think, like, certainly it can go too far, but there is something about what Belle and Sebastian is up to and earnestness to it that is just very endearing. And I think that's especially true on If You're Feeling Sinister. There's not an ounce of hard or rough or edge or, you know, vitriol or, I mean, there's negative emotion, but there's, like, no anger on this thing. Like, it is... I guess saccharine in a sense. Like, I don't think it's, I guess it is kind of maudlin. Like, I don't think it's saccharine in that, like, it's naivety, but like it's, there's just sort of an abiding sweetness, especially compared to like what else is happening in the 90s. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I mean, part of it is just in what's his butt's voice, right?
Stuart Murdoch.
Yeah, it's just like part of it is just how Stuart Murdoch sounds, like the sort of whispery, quiet. Never met an SH he couldn't turn into a th. just like this, but like that even makes it quieter, you know. Like it takes away a lot of the sibilance you would get in you know most other language or lyrics, and replaces it with this much more like lullaby-ish kind of quality, even if the song is more upbeat.
So yeah, Stuart Murdoch is our I suppose main person here. The story goes that he was suffering from chronic fatigue syndrome for a long time, and when you have chronic fatigue syndrome you just can't really go anywhere, so he was basically pent up and started writing songs, and they are these very sweet, very earnest, very genuine observational story songs. And he, as a result, has this kind of like hopeful outsider perspective. And I mean, and you feel, if you're feeling sinister, especially, I think you hear that comes like, they're all songs about, I mean, adolescent moments, mostly, it feels like, or early 20s even, and those are the moments that Murdoch missed out on, so that makes a lot of sense, and it's like him trying to go, you know, just have these empathetic moments and to actually tell these stories, allow these characters some space, and to, like, just do this imaginative work. It's all simple chords and arrangements. You're not going to hear anything shocking here. It's gentle delivery, as Tim was saying. And it's, I mean, it's good writing, like, right? He's a bookish fellow, and you can sense that. Lot of comparisons to the Smiths for the worse. You can deal with that if you want to.
No, I mean, you definitely hear it in there. Like, you're sort of listening, you're like, okay, who does this particular vibe sound like? And you sort of reach for Morrissey, but it's, I don't know, just the sound of the bands really could not be more different to me.
That's my thing. Like, there's no Johnny Marr here, which I'm not saying it's fault, but just, like, fundamentally different sound.
No, it's like a fundamentally different approach. Yeah. And, like, Morrissey is a lot of things, unfortunately, but I don't know that Twee is one of them.
No, he's not. That's my other thing. Like, yeah, bookish storytelling, like, I don't know, heightened emotion, sure, but I don't know. Murdoch and Morrissey could not be more different.
I could not imagine the two of them, like, looking each other in the eye for very long, because Morrissey would be a jerk and walk away or something.
Morrissey probably has thoughts about Scotsman at this point, too. your friends. See, I chose the band that's actually aging well.
Yeah, dichotomy. Seriously, though.
I mean, the other thing here is that this is, I briefly mentioned this, just radically out of step with what else is happening in the 90s. Grunge, Britpop, new metal, et cetera, like all this harder stuff with oftentimes an ironic bent or a deep, like a socially conscious bent, and not that Belle and Sebastian isn't doing that, but they're doing it in a less railing way, in a more kind of understanding way. But even the pop rock that's famous at the time, your Third Eye Blinds, your Matchbox 20s, your Sheryl Crow's, your pick a name, those have more boom than anything on Belle and Sebastian. And like that softness, that like Baroque folkiness, you can, who is it? Tom Breheim, great columnist for Stereo Gum, who's been going through every number one song ever and writing about them.
No.
Yeah. He's pretty far into it now. Look him up. It's great. He just released a book, too, that's like 20 select ones, but he's been going through every one that is ranked number one on the Billboard 100, and doing an article for each one. It's an incredible series. He's great. But he talks about he says in particular the timidity of Belle and Sebastian in like late 90s, early 2000s in particular gets Americanized. He points out Death Cab for Cutie in particular, also mentions Sufjan Stevens and the Decemberists. Like there's this sincere bookish timidity to all of them. And so, right, that sound gets Americanized and then pitched to us as, right, those bands. So, all three of those probably more widely popular at this point. Anyone listening, I'm sure you know at least one of those. So, like, that's, you know, earlier when I said you've heard Belle and Sebastian, you've heard them. Like, they have a long shadow, a long influence.
There was this very funny moment for me when I was listening to this and the stars of Track and Field, and I'm like, I know this song, don't I? Isn't there an almost identical song about sports from another band like this? Like that was my moment of like, oh yes, they are literally everywhere. They have just seeped into those people.
The sporting life. Which is not to say that all of those three acts I mentioned are derivative. They're all doing something really interesting in their own. I love two of them dearly and respect the third, but I can't. I'm like, Sufjan's good. It's just not my thing totally. So, right, it's getting picked up and like taken forward in really interesting ways. But, you know, major thing here, and you can hear a lot of like, you know, 60s chamber pop in particular coming through in Belle and Sebastian, or like the influence anyway. But, you know, back in 96, this is just very out of step with everything that's happening. And it's going to set up a lot of what comes in the 2000s. So sneakily one of the most influential albums on the list, probably in the top 100. Certainly not 65th by that measure. And as a way of vague transition, there are a lot of one-liners on here that you may cringe at, but that you may also find sweet in how earnest they are and delivered. One of my favorites, "I could kill you, but I can only make you cry with these words." And
twee.
Yeah. When you hear it out of context, you groan, but it's also, you hear it delivered and you're like, yeah, that's kind of the thing. another one I want to point out, Judy and the Dream of Horses. If you're ever feeling blue, then write another song. And the line continues about your horses. But like, if you just take that part, if you're ever feeling blue, then write another song about whatever makes you happy, whatever brings you joy. Like, that's the mission statement of If You're Feeling Sinister, of Belle and Sebastian. The title track is a lot about religious angst, which I say only to see if Tim jumps to bite at that one.
Why? Do I have a history with that or something?
That's why you love The Exorcist.
No, that was a joke. I was, you know,
yeah, I know.
They can't see my incredibly expressive face on the pod, but when they listen to this, they will now know that was
not until we do the video pod.
No. No.
But I do think that's as good a mission statement as you'll find for this album, for any album, really. Like, that's the last song, but it really crystallizes a lot of what's going on here. I think how Murdoch was approaching a lot of this earlier stuff in particular, too, because of his condition, because of how he had to write, the conditions of that. And just this sense that, like, you're gonna feel sad, you're gonna feel blue, you're gonna have bad days and months and years, but, right, there is a way out of that, that you have the capacity to get through that, to write through that, to be creative through that. And that comes down to this, right, these displays of empathy, these attempts at storytelling, just these creative impulses. And like, that's what Murdoch's doing for himself, and I think that's what really comes through and If You're Feeling Sinister. Right, the title in itself becomes especially interesting then, because it's, you know, if you are, then okay, do this, like, recreate this, be like, right, experience this with us and try it on your own. And it's this really generous kind of spirit to the whole album, I think. And I find that very, I keep coming back to sweet, and it sounds like, it sounds rude after a while, but it's very sweet. Like, this is just a very nice album. And you know, you're not coming here for great displays of, like, technicality, but it's all crafted incredibly well. And it's just good little folky pop tunes. And Murdoch has still, I think, a voice and a perspective that is very genuine and kind of out of step with a lot of other stuff happening, even if it is abidingly twee.
Well, you know, it's funny you're saying that bit about the lacking the technicality aspect, because I am lizard brained about this, of course I thought about Pavement again. Just like, Pavement could never, is basically what I came away with. It's just they would not have that level of, I don't know, like, generousness, I think is the word you were using. And I think it is a generous album.
The Pavement's not the one I go to. It's the Magnetic Fields that I go to. The other one that we hate on.
Yeah.
Like, what everyone thinks 69 Love Songs is, this is.
Mm-hmm.
Any more on If You're Feeling Sinister?
No, I feel like I should say, like, I really did like this one a lot. It's super easy to get to and get through.
Mm-hmm.
I was sort of like bummed out when it was over. I was listening on Spotify, and then a Fleet Foxes thing popped up. I'm like, not that I'm like against Fleet Foxes, I'm just like, oh, my album is over. And I was like, I miss you. Like,
no, we support Fleet Foxes, but yeah, I don't want it to feel like I'm underselling this one. We both really like this. It's just, it's a good time. It's a very generous album, as we were saying, and it's just a very pleasant listen. And it's like 40 minutes or something. It's not all that long at all. But again, there's probably stuff that you listen to that if you're not familiar with Belle and Sebastian already, go check out this. Go check out Boy with the Arab Strap. And you'll connect a lot of dots for yourself. And hopefully you'll find a new band that you like. Not new, but...
new to you.
New to you. And I think that's what we can do here, is just spread word, the good word of Belle and Sebastian. This album is like, I think it was like 14th or something on the Pitchfork top 100 of the 90s. Like, it's something that charts and reviews incredibly well still. And I'm really curious how long that continues.
Well, in that case, maybe it is the bridge on the River Kwai, because African Queen is... Oh, it is disappearing fast.
Hey, yeah, this isn't doing it yet, but I fear for it. The other moral here is go check out Tom Breheim and his
I'm gonna have to,
insane project.
I was about to say, I know what I'm doing this afternoon now.
So, Twee is not the theme for today, though. It could have been. It probably should have been. I realize now, but we're doing something that is...
I like
we're
this doing theme.
I do, too. It's closely related to Twee, honestly. Our theme is going to be New Sincerity. Tim will get to choose which album best suits that theme, based on the arguments presented, and all chosen albums head to their subtitles replacement list. Remember, the goal is not to choose the work that's best or most important, but to choose the one that best suits the theme. New Sincerity... Maybe I'll just lead this off like I did with Belle and Sebastian. Who still thinks about New Sincerity, Tim? That's a genuine question.
Fewer people.
That's what I was wondering. Well, quick explainer here. Basically, it's a reaction to postmodernism, and I know your eyes just rolled to the back of the people listening.
I mean, my eyebrows went up just a teensy bit.
Yeah, but your eyes didn't roll to the back of your head. I know you all think I'm on my shit here, but it's a reaction against the irony and sarcasm and subversion of postmodernism, of postmodern technique. And it's an investment in... I'm going to go through what a couple of different people say about it, but you'll hear it differently. But it's an investment in joy and sincerity and earnestness and genuineness. You can see I'm using all the same words I did for Belle and Sebastian. Like, it's this... sort of a down with ironic detachment, up with sincere engagement. And it's something that showed up in a lot of different art forms. It gets expressed in different ways, obviously, as all of these little era genres do. but in general, it's something that comes about in the 90s in particular, as a reaction to high postmodernism, finds its ultimate muse in David Foster Wallace, which you may have your thoughts on him. I certainly do. And then I think as itself peters out in the 2000s, but I do think it's right. We have New Sincerity in a lot of how we think now and a lot of artistic expression. But I'm going to be talking about Belle and Sebastian, obviously, but also Cat Power and Broken Social Scene as expressions of New Sincerity, and those albums also being this late 90s, early 2000s moment. So to me, I kind of see it in there, probably a 10-year stretch, like 95 to 2005, where it's particularly rife. And of course, it carries over after that, but we'll look at those two. Anything you want to say about New Sincerity before I get into some definitions from people?
I think just mostly that I think the mantle of sincerity is now being carried by television, but it's not a new sincerity, but like a like a threadbare sincerity, which I think also gives a sense of time. So, yeah, I prefer new to threadbare personally.
One of our folks talks about it in TV. We'll get to that in just a second. Early expressions include Jesse Thorne, who has kind of a cagey relationship to it anyway, but sets it up as like, it's the celebration of joy and a rejection of irony. And again, Thorne has a interesting and hypocritical moment with what he's saying later on, but I do think that's a pretty effective definition of celebrate joy, reject irony. Like, that's it's reductive, but it's a good crisp kind of initial understanding of what New Sincerity is doing. Folks like Jonathan Fitzgerald and Graydon Carter pick up on this, writing for The Atlantic and Vanity Fair respectively, and they are writing in the 2000s in particular and see 9/11 as kind of the pivotal moment of it was bubbling before that, but really that just killed the momentum for ironic attachment, for sarcasm, for like artistic expression as fundamentally based in insincerity. That 9/11 for American audiences in particular really breaks that. So they're kind of looking at like historicizing a little bit. Andrew Watercutter and Wired writes about it as like, really it's when we stop feeling guilty pleasures and we just embrace what makes us happy, what brings us joy, what we get pleasure out of, that like the guilty part of that can go away. Like, there is no abiding sense of cool that we have to either fashion ourselves into or pretend that we're part of, that it's just you like what you like and you feel good about that. And then the our dude looking at TV, like Tim is ready to, James Poniewozik looks at it again from TV in particular, but it's this move from irony to sincerity. And you may be thinking, yeah, that seems pretty definitional. But he elaborates that it's not the tone in itself, but it's the perspective of the show, of the written show. It's this move from the show as a different perspective from its protagonist. It's a move from the Sopranos is saying something different than Tony Soprano is, to this, not equivocation, but like collation of, okay, the show and its protagonists, whatever, like they have the same outlook. It's a condensing of those things. And he uses Ted Lasso as a very recent and good example that like the show and the person mean the same thing. There's not that narrative detachment between the two. And in as much as we think about New Sincerity as a artistic mode, that's the way to think about it. And that's the reaction to, right, that kind of postmodern detachment. So it's not necessarily a like, here's my outlook on life. It's no, we can analyze this and like how narratives are structured. And I think he gives us a good way of thinking about that through TV, that's really the move we're making. It's, you know, I'm not, and in music, we can think the same. It's like, I'm not, you know, secretly, I don't think something different than what the song is saying. Like the writer and the protagonist, or the writer and the subject of the song. Music gets weird because, right, we always assume that those are the same, and usually they are separate, and that makes sense. But it's not a game of like figuring out what the difference is. New sincerity in music is like, okay, these things are together. All right, this is an expression of some genuine feeling. There's not like a secret carrot on a stick behind it all. We're going to get to Foster Wallace in a second, but anything on those? Do you want to jump on the TV thing?
I think to some extent there's something in New Sincerity where like it's at least in the places where I don't like it very much, which is which I realize is a form of cherry picking for sure. I think it's that difference of having that generous feeling and having that like self-improvement, self-help book feeling, which I don't think, if you're feeling sinister, is supposed to give you this sense of like inspiration so much as like reassurance, which is a very different idea. But when I think about it in like television in particular, even with shows that I like fairly well, so often it's like got this sort of moral or self-help piece to it. So Ted Lasso fits into this, but so does everything Michael Schur touches at this point. Mm-hmm. The second half of Parks and Rec is like this. The Good Place is like this. Like, this feeling of the most important thing we can be is improving ourselves instead of, like, laughing at jokes on television.
Which is why we love Archer.
Yeah.
Foster Wallace is, of course, the big name in all this and doing the literary aspect of it. I'm just going to read a little bit from his E Unibus Plurum essay. Just get this out of the way now for anyone wondering. Foster Wallace, the essayist? I love. Foster Wallace, the fiction writer? Hate the man. I'm going to leave it at that. But he writes here, the next real literary rebels in this country might well emerge as some weird bunch of anti-rebels, born oglers who dare somehow to back away from ironic watching, who have the childish gall actually to endorse and instantiate single entendre principles, who treat of plain old untrendy human troubles and emotions in U.S. life with reverence and conviction, who eschew self-consciousness and hip fatigue. These anti-rebels would be outdated, of course, before they even started. Dead on the page, too sincere, clearly repressed, backward, quaint, naive, anachronistic. Maybe that'll be the point. Maybe that's why they'll be the next real rebels. it's pretty to think so, isn't it?
All I can think about are, like, trad wife posters on Instagram. Like, that's like, it's not about her being traditional. It's not about whether or not she can butcher a chicken. It's about it's about whether or not she has boobs. Like, that's really what it comes down to.
I laugh because that's genuinely funny, but it also made me think, like, I think Foster Wallace was actually onto something, but the internet absolutely destroyed the possibility of it. Like, there's no way for large swaths of people to actually have this means of expression through something so performative.
Yeah, no, I agree with that. I would say, like, just sort of listening to it, I'm like, yeah, this tracks, like, this sort of, like, this feeling of people who the uncoolness is the point.
Mm-hmm.
This feeling of I want to be a little bit revanchist in a way, you know, and that's the point of this, not to be, they're not thinking of themselves as counter-revolutionaries. They're thinking about themselves as, like, getting back to who I really am, which is.
But it's all branding is mostly my point.
And it's all, like, all a branding thing. Like, so, like, trad wives.
Yeah, I think Foster Wallace was on to something in, when was that essay? Was that 96 as well? 93.
Wow.
No, 93. That would have been too nice. That's
still
close.
I was about to say, 93 is pretty good for that.
Which, again, I think there's something truly interesting and compelling there, but it's become another brand, right? His sense of the anti-rebel there, or the next true rebel, is performative now. And I'm sure he knew that was the danger. Like, of course he did. Like, it's in all his writing. And, you know, one of his most famous pieces, This Is Water, I think a compelling kind of version of what a new sincerity might look like how we might reorient our minds just a little bit to be more sincere, regardless of whether that's rebellious or not. Like, that doesn't matter. It is about this sincerity, this genuineness, this generousness as well. I think it's pretty clear how Belle and Sebastian fit into this. There's no subtext here. There's no ironic detachment. Like, the songs are the songs, and they will do for us emotionally what they can, but, you know, it's kind of up to us to pick that up or not. They're not fighting to engage us at multiple levels. It's just, here are these empathetic, nice songs that you can listen to and, like, feel inspired, maybe. Or feel reassured, I think was the word you put on it. I think there is some inspiration there, but it's not the self-help kind. But it's sincerity. It's very sincere, and I think that's going to be true of the two replacements we talk about. But also, to avoid any confusion or people clapping back at me, there is an actual small movement in music that was called New Sincerity, and it's the late 80s in Austin, and none of those bands matter. You'll heard of none of them. None of them made any effect or ripple. But moving forward,
I was about to say, that's just Richard Linklater, isn't it?
Yeah,
like the
much.
Most successful band from that was Richard Linklater.
It absolutely was. So ignore that. But going forward, know that a smattering of artists I could have talked about here, and that like New Sincerity flows through Arcade Fire, although canceled. Not talking about them. Neutral Milk Hotel, already talked about them. Good band. Sufjan, invoked him earlier. Bright Eyes, Connor Oberst, however you know that entity. Joanna Newsom, who, more talented than her husband, even if you know her husband more. And, of course, our two options for today, Broken Social Scene and Cat Power. Both artists I really love, so we're going to try and behave here. We'll start with Broken Social Scene and their 2002 album, You Forgot It in People. Tim, how do you know Broken Social Scene?
Mostly as part of that cohort of bands that my social cohort was listening to in high school when I was listening to show tunes.
Not the Replacements?
No. No, they're definitely in that particular group.
Canadian, I'm going to say entity, because there are so many people that end up doing something for this band. There is a core of like five folks that have been in it since 2001 or so.
That face that you guys didn't see was the face I made looking at Broken Social Scene and the little thing on Wikipedia at the bottom, and just seeing the huge number of names. It's like enough to man a small orchestra.
Yep. And oftentimes they sound like a small orchestra. So it's Kevin Drew and, oh God, Andrew, I forgot his last name.
I'd support
you,
but you
were looking
there,
at it.
I am looking at it. Andrew Whiteman. It doesn't mean I can find it fast.
Those are the two main guys. And they've been around, I mean, the formation of the band in 99, and then I think like three other dudes come along in 2001 or so, and that's your core band. They're going to be doing most of the writing and playing, and when they tour, like, you're going to see them, and then you're going to see who knows on top of that. The most famous consistent contributors here are Emily Haynes, who is responsible for probably their most popular song. And you know who it is.
I do know who this is.
Feist. Can't wait to talk about Feist on her own. So yeah, Feist kind of sort of gets her start in this band and then transcends it by virtue of Apple, I think. And she'll come back occasionally, like her and Haynes both. They seem to show up anytime there's a new album and they'll record some stuff, but they're not really doing the touring or the bulk of the playing or anything like that anymore. I mentioned that, one, to just give some historical context, but two, to say that this band is always better when one of the women is singing, and they're writing really cool stuff besides, and, you know, Drew sings quite a bit, and like that stuff's good, but it's so much better when Haynes or Feist grabs lead vocal. To that end, we have what is probably their most popular song. I feel confident in saying that. Anthems for a 17-year-old girl.
Mm-hmm. That is one that I even know, so I'm gonna say that's likely.
Subject of periodic tweets when there's some moral outrage, and one of the music critics I follow will just be, I think everyone, you know, should relax, and really what we should do is park that car, drop that phone, sleep on the floor, dream about me. That the big refrain from Anthems. This is the Emily Haynes joint. great vocal throughout. And it sounds very sweet, very sincere. And this is not a song with a bunch of different lyrics. You have that refrain a ton from like the 2 minute mark to the 3:30 mark or something. And it's one of those things that the more that you hear it, the more it becomes real, the more it feels like a call to action, the more it feels like some kind of reassurance or like imagined scenario that you want to be part of. And there's a deliberateness to the action eventually of park that car, drop that phone, sleep on the floor, dream about, like, right, the more you hear it, and Tim's giggling because when you hear it out of context once, it sounds very weird, but after the like 10th time, I don't know, to me, like, it just sounds like a very sincere call. And it sounds like, you know, not to make it too internet-y, but like, go touch grass, like a genuine expression of that feeling.
I think that's more why I was laughing. Just like, just the brevity of the statements makes everything just sort of seem a little bit simpler, a little bit easier to like, yeah, to swallow.
The other great line in this one, you'll hear it a few times, not in succession though. Succession, not secession. You used to be one of the rotten ones, and I liked you for that. Which on its face, right, that's dangerously close to not new sincerity, to like a 90s ironic cool thing, like, you used to be one of the rotten ones, man, but now you sold out. Like, it's real close when you just hear it like that. What changes that is, one, Haynes's delivery, but two, where it goes from there. And think of the title again. This is Haynes writing, like, at once this kind of reflective piece, but also this, not warning, but just like statement of fact, really, to adolescent girls, that like, you have this kind of freedom, this sort of genuine spirit, this kind of I don't know, singularity, really, that you will lose eventually. Now you're all gone, put your makeup on, and you're not coming back. This is how it continues, that like, eventually you will become part of this sort of cloned branded aesthetic. I'm putting words on it that I don't think Haynes would, but it's like, it's sad to see that loss, and it seems inevitable. And there is a tinge of sadness to the music through all this thing, which is really led by a banjo and this, there's some, you know, some swelling strings, but they're, you know, pretty emotional, pretty windswept, if anything, and this kind of brushed percussion cymbal playing throughout. Like, it is this sad but driving music for a song that is really about loss, loss of a kind of singular freedom. And it's partially reflective of, man, I used to have that, but also watching other girls go through that is really emotional. And it's, I mean, not to keep using the word itself, but like, it's very sincere. And I think the repetition really does help that of all the lines. I'm spending a lot of time on that one, A, because it's their most popular, but B, I also think it's emblematic of what's happening. You're not getting a ton of like vocal heavy song or lyric heavy songs throughout this. Anthems is one of the heavier ones. So I'm going to talk about the music a little bit too in other places, but I do think Anthems is really emblematic of sincerity of perspective and of what is actually being talked about when they are singing, when there are like lyric heavy songs throughout this thing. Any thoughts on that one? You leaned forward at one point. I didn't know if you had something.
No, I do like that there is, like, to me, this is such a difficult thing about being sincere, is that it is incredibly difficult to be sincere while at the same time not sounding like everyone else, but maybe just because I'm a jerk, I think that if you sound like everyone else, you must be insincere. which mm-hmm. I know that's not literally true, but like this is how my brain works, and it is nice. Not just nice. It's like genuinely very interesting when someone can say something that sounds sincere, has like that twinge of other people are saying it, but it doesn't feel reductive or reiterative, and that's something special about this mm-hmm. particular piece.
I think it also demonstrates good understanding of the band of like who needs to sing when, because if Kevin Drew does this, it does not work for multiple reasons. First and foremost, he's a dude, so it's going to sound predatory. But like, mm-hmm. even if it's him writing about like the loss of male adolescence, like that just does not work the same as Haynes's very melodic and melodious voice delivering this. Right, I wouldn't say particularly impassioned. It's kind of, I don't know, stark at times, in that like she's not really rising above a certain register or a certain level. It does seem very matter of fact, but again, I think the repetition in particular really helps it become something that just sticks with you, and you realize this is gonna happen, and it's a sad moment. But like being able to commune about it here is something, at least. So it's not just empty nostalgia either, I think. Like, it's not saying we can all get back to that. It's like, no, you're going to lose it. But, you know, we can think about that here. If you're feeling blue, write a song about whatever it is you're feeling blue about. The other thing here is, musically, like Anthem's lyrically, how it's very close to being anti-nuisance here. Musically, this is an art house band with like orchestral impulses. You'd not be wrong to think of Electric Light Orchestra in there, but ooh. Like ELO, yeah, there you go. Like ELO, tremendous command of pop craft. You know, Jeff Lynne can take all these wild impulses he has, all these Baroque influences, all of these chamber pop ideals and this abiding progginess and turn it into a really nice 3-4 minute pop song. Broken Social Scene is doing a lot of the same here. So these are all really lush, grandiose songs that are trying to crystallize some sort of feeling. And generally that is loss. Like that's pervasive in this album. But you'll get different expressions of this, all of them gorgeous. Late 90s bedroom, I wrote an ellipses here, so I'm try and remember this fully correctly. Late 90s bedroom rock for missionaries. Great song title. Sorry if I got anything wrong there. It's like this squalled jazzy thing. Lover Spit. I hear some Coldplay in it, or rather I hear Lover Spit in Coldplay. Casey Accidental has some Appleseed Cast or Winter Sleep about it, which I recognize are two less popular bands than Broken Social Scene, but I've written about them. Go find those. Almost Crimes is, I think Drew said the initial recording was too close to the Strokes and they had to rework it a lot. And you can hear it in there, but like the newer version, it's somewhere between like New Pornographers and Interpol. This is a band with range. Like they're doing these kind of grandiose indie art house expressions, but they're super good at what they're doing, and they become really great and accessible pop songs. So it really is a great demonstration of just how do you take these rangy, wild influences, and how do you work with 12 different people to make single and substantial songs. And I think Broken Social Scene does that as well as anything. But I think there's a sincerity to that too, that it's not, oh, here, let us flex our muscle that we can do it, or it's not like, let's be as proggy and as obtuse as possible. It's, no, we have all these things. There's a generousness to it, again, and they've talked about this too. Like, when you have 12 different instrumentalists in a room, man, you got to figure out how that works, especially if you want to write something 4 minutes long. So they're not, you know, just giving into, okay, well, everyone gets a solo moment. It's no, how do we make all these things work together? How do we make this cohesive in some way? So I think there's a sincerity and expression there as well. Put kind of a button on this. If you're not familiar with Broken Social Scene, they're Canadian, but they kind of fit with this Pacific Northwest alt rock moment in the 2000s. You can hear some like Jeff Buckley and Elliott Smith in there, Death Cab for Cutie, Belle and Sebastian, New Pornographers. I mentioned ELO already. So, you know, kind of a range of similar bands there. What'd I get wrong?
Oh, no. I was looking up where people were from in Canada because, like.
Yeah, I don't actually know where in Canada, but.
Apparently it's a Toronto.
Okay, that makes sense.
Which, I mean, like, listen. If it's Canadian, it's basically the Pacific Northwest anyway. Like, it's either the Pacific Northwest or Montana. So, like, those are the two flavors.
And that one's Modest Mouse. I thought they were Ontario. So I left that vague because I didn't think they were British Columbia. But it's a lot of shared mess going on there. Anything on Broken Social Scene or You Forgot It in People? Did I mention the album title? The album we're talking about is You Forgot It in People, their 2002 debut.
I don't remember if you said the album title.
I don't either, but now I did.
Let's do the next one and also say the album title for that one at the front and see if that changes things.
Hey, Cat Power and her 1998 album Moon Picks. That's the album Moon Picks. The album called Moon Picks by Cat Power.
This is an outstanding place for us to spoonerize the album Poon Mix by Cat Power.
Well, I know what we're doing.
And that's our show.
Anyway, Moon Picks, the album.
There's this collection of songs on this thing that you just wouldn't believe.
There's a collection of songs on Moon Picks that I don't know what better illustrates what Moon Picks is. What... Get stuck in my own bit. What are your thoughts on Cat Power? I don't want to just take 20 minutes to fawn, so that's why we're starting
here.
No,
that's fair. Just that, like, there's this thread of 90s, like, individual, like, solo artists who we've gone through, either because they were on the spin list or because you like had them as potential replacements, and they range from like Liz Phair to Lauryn Hill to Alanis Morissette, and like I don't think Cat Power is really like any of them at all. So like I'm trying to think back to like the episode with like Sharon Van Etten and things, and like maybe that's a little closer, but like
Van Etten, maybe Saint Vincent, no, PJ Harvey, yeah,
that's what I was thinking. Like I don't think that like even the people who are more like emotionally compatible with her are necessarily mm-hmm. like the right fit, like in that way. There is almost something Bjork-y going on here,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
but just not, you know, Bjork-y.
Cat Power is a one of one who Bjork-y hear it immediately just because of musically what's going on there. You don't necessarily do that with Cat Power, I don't think. Like, you have to sit with these songs on Moon Picks, the album, and live in them for a while, and you realize that real name Chan Marshall, like there's just a heaviness, man. The heaviness that we like to talk about in like Johnny Cash's cover of Hurt, like that's all of Cat Power's stuff. Not necessarily thematically, but just like there's this absolute commanding presence that she's not really trying for, I don't think. Like, it's just inherent. And you live in these songs and just kind of feel with them. And to me, that's the ultimate sincerity thing. I do think this bumps up against a potential problem in that, like, I don't think we should think of new sincerity as, like, it has to be singular. Like, you have to be radically individual to be sincere. You were sort of talking about this earlier. Like, I don't think that's the case. I think that is true for Cat Power, that, like, the listening experience here is just very unique. But, you know, at the risk of suggesting that, like, that's what makes something more sincere, well, that just, like, that's doomed from the start.
I have to say, it is not true, even if I would love it if it were. It is not how this works.
I think what I want to focus on with Cat Power and Moonpics, if I said it enough.
Maybe.
I think like 8 more times probably.
I will. I think there is some confusion about what exactly it is on the sort of like platonic level. But we can cover that maybe in the spiel, talk about the platonic underlinings of what might be an album.
Album. Let me tell you, there's few better than Moonpics. What I want to focus on here is she hears possibilities and emotions where most of us never would if not for her. And I think a lot of times how she does that and expresses it resembles methods of, let me put it this way, De La Soul, we talked about a while ago. Their albums are on Spotify now. Everyone go finally check those out.
It's been that long that they're finally on Spotify.
We talked about, right, that whole episode is built around sampling as art form and as, the tiresome argument of, like, well, if you're just sampling stuff, then you're not really making music and, like, blah, blah, blah. I'm not tagging De La Soul here, but just them as kind of like the peak of the art form of, right, that very easily becomes pastiche, becomes assemblage, becomes, right, you just put things together for this kind of ironic subversion. I'm not saying De La Soul does that, but just like if we think about that kind of art form, William S. Burroughs does this. And right, it becomes that, think about it from the TV angle again, it's this detachment between text and creator, not necessarily a tonal, like, oh, it's all irony. Like, there's that sort of detachment there in that style. Cat Power's doing that a lot, but it becomes even heavier when she does it, and I think it's because of how well she chooses. A great example here is the opening song, American Flags, where she takes the drum loop on the Beastie Boys song, Paul Revere. Here's a little story about Paul Revere, et cetera, et cetera. That's peak postmodernism. She takes that drum loop, turns it backwards, and that's your song. It has some distorted guitar happening throughout. It throws in a few little drum rolls, and it sounds like someone's taking a hammer to piano string, like just opened the top of a grand piano and is hitting the playing the strings rather than the keys. It is by any metric, like, a very messy song, and yet her voice brings it all together. And, you know, we were saying about Stuart Murdoch, how, right, it's kind of that whispery thing, like it draws you in closer and closer. Marshall does that as well as anybody, I think. You just feel absolutely absorbed by whatever she's singing, and she can belt when she wants to, and she does on American Flags a little bit, and it makes those moments even more impactful. But there's like a honeyed smokiness to her voice that is so, Again, you just kind of get lost in it. It exists in and through these songs, and I started thinking about listening to this album in particular as like, you're in a room with a bunch of people, and she takes command of the room, and you hear her everywhere, but you can't actually see her. So you're doing these like constant double takes and just looking around for this presence that you can't fully identify. And like with Murdoch, there's some, you know, potential like personal history that goes into this mythologizing, where still in this 1998 moment, Marshall is so shy, is so uncomfortable on stage that some shows didn't happen. She would get through a song and then leave. She would end up crying in the middle of play. Like, there's this deep uncomfortableness with what she's actually doing. The recording, the songwriting, all great, but the actual performative aspect, she has since become much more, I guess, comfortable, but just much more consistent in like touring and doing shows. And, you know, thankfully for her and for all of us, but there is kind of that in the mythology too, where it's like, it's so sincere that she can't even do it live herself. Like, it has to exist on record because it can't be recreated over and over. And again, some of that is mythologizing, but like that's literal personal history. Like, that's actually true. And I think it comes through in the songwriting a bit too. You get a lot of songs on here that are second person, which is a certainly less common approach than first or third person in songwriting.
You know what this reminds me of, and this is like a very good example of why individuality is not a guarantee, is like, this is part of Adele's thing too. It's just like, Adele like can play like a larger venue, but like there is a lot of like crying in her shows. Like, she is like very, very like overwhelmed with emotion every single time. And like there's something similar. Again, I think Adele has not had like the can't finish shows things, but like it's the same like genius.
Yeah, it is. I'm not gonna hate on Adele here. Like, props to her for all her success in particular. I think there is probably a difference though in that, like, a lot of her songs are these, okay, let's feel and weep together. And that's not necessarily what's happening in Cat Power. It's just this, like, it overwhelms her point, and the rest of us are confused. So like, they're songs that are so sincere and so generous that she can't do them. But the rest of us are having our own experiences rather than a shared cry, which, look, nothing against a shared cry. I've made the argument that we need more of that. But I do think it's like a little bit different, but that's a good point that like, maybe we can think of Adele as like the popular kind of model of what this might look like. I also, not to, oh, I was saying with the writing. So it, right on this one in particular, there's a lot of second person. So it's a lot of like deferring as well. And right, immediately invoking you as listener, making you do like, imagine yourself in these spaces. I think that's reflective of kind of where she is at this moment in time. But I do think that also adds to the earnestness of it all, the invitingness of it, the generosity of it. Like, these are songs in which she's inviting you to be part of. And I think that connection, that communal aspect is really important for what's happening on Moonpix. There's one. I made the other one too much about the internet, so let's make this one too much about the internet. The mortifying ordeal of being known. Love that meme, especially when it's cat related. That's Cat Power to me in a meme. Like, this is the mortifying ordeal of being known.
Okay.
That makes sense to you.
Mm-hmm.
Two more things and then I'll wrap this up. I'll be good. Like with the musical approach, for the most part, this is her and I think a three-piece band that is showing a tremendous amount of restraint which is harder than just like letting it rip. It's really talented session musicians that she's working with here, but they are working with great precision, and like it's sparse and haunting on purpose, and that's really hard to create. That's harder to create than just like, let's show off our acuity. No, let's pull it all back and strip it down to the bare, to be threadbare. But we have two more moments, one on Say, where a repeated line is, I hope all is well. And you hear that, and we as jaded listeners immediately, like, okay, well, here's the, like, oh, yeah, that's meant to be funny. No, I don't actually, but, like, again, in the delivery and the vulnerability and the huskiness of her voice, you think, oh, that's real. Like, this is a song about her kind of hating herself, but like, that's a genuine expression of emotion. I do hope all is well, even if you tore my heart out. So, you know, for as much like writing deferral as we may have in other places, we get moments like that where it's like, okay, that's going to be such a cliche. But like with, okay, what if I flip the drum loop to Paul Revere and make a song out of that? Like, no one else is going to think about that. Who else can take a line this cliched and give it such depth of feeling? And in Metal Heart, this happens again where she interpolates Amazing Grace. Like, you interpolates the melody a little bit, and then just has the actual lyrics to Amazing Grace. And again, it's a moment where it's like, okay, you're going to bring that in. It's going to be some kind of detachment, but like, it's the perfect thing for that moment of feeling. And to me, that's the power and what's so captivating about Cat Power, that again, she just hears feelings and emotions and possibilities where others don't. And then, I mean, borderline obsesses with sharing that with us, with having those shared moments of going through that together, to the point where it often overwhelmed her, and I'm sure still does. So to me, that's just an incredible form of sincerity, and of vulnerability and of openness and of a generosity verging on like self-harm in a way. Like, it was too much for her for so long. What is sincere if not that kind of radical openness? So yeah, Moonpix. Anything on that or Cat Power?
There's like a certain like bravery in the sincerity as well, in the way that she kind of opens up to stuff like Beastie Boys and Amazing Grace. Like, I do think that there's something like, this is genuinely what I am up to here, and like, it is something which I think is risky, because like, a person could like chortle at that and not take these extremely serious emotions that she has with the seriousness that she would hope for. So like, to me, that's also an interesting piece of the sincerity here.
That's another thing. She has a very wide palette. And you may look at, you know, we talk about too many acts now. It's like, oh, they're genre encompassing. But like, I don't know, 98, think of like Beck or something, where like, you can hear it because he's stuffing all those different pieces in it, but Cat Power kind of hides it in a way. Like, yeah, here's this sample from License to Ill, or she has a bunch of cover records, and some of her most popular ones are like, it's the Rolling Stones, and then the Velvet Underground, and then Frank Ocean, and then this weird like sci-fi pop rock band that no one knows. Like, she has a kind of insatiable palette and just realm of influence, I think, and she's pulling all of that in, and you have to listen close, but you can hear the like, oh, okay, that like, yeah, she's well versed in R&B, or like, that has this really blues aspect to it, or she's working with basically jazz session musicians here. Like, it's all there, but it's all stripped to the absolute, like, it's stripped to the studs, and the stud is just, what is the core emotion that needs to be communicated and shared here? And so there's, right, there's a lot of impressive musicality around it. But it really is the, like, the sincerest expression is the most vulnerable one. And that's, that's Moonpix. Anything on this, on anything, any questions, spiel? How you feeling?
Yeah, we can spiel. I'm still sort of like thinking about it, but maybe I'll be pushed a direction.
So our entry today, number 65 on the spin list, is If You're Feeling Sinister, Bell and Sebastian's 1996 album. I'm talking about that album and New Sincerity. So if we understand New Sincerity as a rejection of postmodern irony, of this detachment between person and narrative, of this kind of abiding sense of cool and separation, or detachment rather, and instead an embrace of weakness in a way, and of joy and of things that make us happy, but also this earnest and generous sharing of feeling and of sadness too. Right, that's all through If You're Feeling Sinister. And our options here, first, You Forgot It in People, the 2002 album by Broken Social Scene, I think runs the risk of being too cool for itself almost immediately, and that this is a massive art rock band pulling from everything. And when you have 10, 12, however many musicians in a room, there's a lot of work you have to do to actually make that cohesive. And what they do in making these, you know, 4 or 5 minute pop songs, in making them single compositions, is itself a kind of sincerity, that they're not just giving into, okay, look at all the stuff we could do, but no, how do we make this actually digestible and appealing, and like, how do we make this into something cohesive and unique? And I talked a lot too about anthems for a 17-year-old girl in particular. I think most of the songs on the album are about loss in a certain way, but that one is as this real reflective moment of, right, you have this kind of freedom and sincerity of youth that eventually you will lose. And that's really sad, and we can share in that together here. And that's not going to change it. We're not going to get lost in nostalgia, but there's a power to just actually like feeling that together here, to giving voice to it. And our second option here is Moonpix, 1998 album by Cat Power. I'll just say what I led with there, that like, I think she sees possibilities where others don't, and her ability to share those, to make those worlds all their own, and the heaviness of her emotional worlds that she invites us into, that she encourages us into, that she often invokes us in with the writing itself. It's this sincerity of the moment and of the feeling, and whether that's taking something as overused as Amazing Grace, or as weird as a loop from Paul Revere, or as, right, traditionally cool as like, here's a reference to the Velvet Underground or something, like, it doesn't matter. She pulls from everything equally, and it's about this real sincerity of the moment and of the emotion, of stripping it back to, here's what is most important, and here is this work that we need to do together. Not with a moral bent or aspect, just with a, it's just presence. This album is all about presence to me. It's soft. There's not a ton happening, but you just get absolved or absorbed into it. And to me, there's a sincerity that has to happen there, right? It is absolutely not about detachment. It is anti-detachment to a fault. And you know, at the time, that was often to the detriment of Chan Marshall herself. But for us as listeners, it is this great expression of sincerity. So, Tim, I leave it to you: Cat Power or Broken Social Scene?
So yeah, I think that did clarify things for me a little bit. In the end, I think I'm just sort of more interested in this idea of being
being sincere, not just down to experience, but down to whatever it is that makes you an individual person, which is more than generous, which is the word that we're using for Belle and Sebastian. And I think it's more than kind, which is how I'm going to describe Broken's social scene. But like, it's more like anchorite to me. Like, you're sort of down to just the most atomic level of what you are up in your head and wherever else that sends things, whether that's your heart or your gut or whatever. And the only thing you've got is to just sort of transmit those and speak those. So that is why I am going for Cat Power here. And her... what's the word? Album, Moonpix.
Well, now we really need to think about the platonic idea of album.
The album.
The album Moonpix, Poonmix. It was an episode where Cat Power and Feist were both involved, so I was going to be happy and sad either way. Yeah, two real personal favorites for me here. I really like If You're Feeling Sinister. and certainly you can hear its reach in You Forgot It in People and Moonpix, but like those two reached me more deeply before Belle and Sebastian did. So like, I think that in itself is kind of emblematic of the importance of Belle and Sebastian and of how long that shadow they cast is. Yeah, two real personal favorites for me here, but there's something about Cat Power that is just absolutely transfixing. And yeah, I think what you said makes a lot of sense. I'm happy to see her go through. But love is always to Broken social scene.
I want to just very quickly say that I was going to like do a joke or something about album in a different language. But it turns out that album is the word for album in like every European language. So I guess the joke's on me.
Haha, you can only do it in accents. Anything else you want to say on any of these, on New Sincerity? How do we as jaded internet goers actually engage in New Sincerity of listening?
Oh, okay. Hold on. It's here somewhere.
Okay.
It's about the mortifying ordeal of being known, and I went to Know Your Meme for this. And found one that I hadn't seen before. You know, the dog with the frisbee?
Yeah.
Please, rewards of being loved. No mortifying ordeal of being known. Only rewards of being loved.
Aw. That is really good.
It's a very strong use of that meme.
Yeah. Thank you all for listening. If you want to check out more about us, who we are, what we do, the genesis of the podcast, check out our blogs, check out his reviews and Letterboxd, check out my playlists and Spotify. And if you want to catch up on back episodes of the podcast, please go to our website, subtitlespodcast.com. And please also feel the rewards of being loved. Not the mortifying ordeal of being known. Go catch a frisbee with a dog if that helps. Live sincerely and live generously. And stay tuned for part two when Tim will talk about the Belle and Sebastian of the movie world.